Welcome to episode 12. And as promised, we have wonderful special guests. And in fact, two for the price of one, because we trailed the wonderful first guest and we have another one joining. I'm going to let you both introduce yourselves. So I'm going to go to you first. Tell us who you are.
I'm Stacey Thundercliffe. I've worked in UK train operations within engineering for the best part of the last 20 years, working for Transpennine Express twice, cross country, and most recently Avanti West Coast. I'm a chartered engineer working in rolling stock fleet maintenance for all of my career. Really enjoyed it so far, and just about to move into my next role in consultancy.
Thanks, Stacey. And today is International Women in Engineering Day, which is a total coincidence because we're not that organised on Parallel Lines. But we thought, being as it is that, we'd make this episode about fleet and everything to do with fleet delivery. And so we invited along another special guest to join us. So please introduce yourself.
I'm Rachel Stretton. I'm Head of Fleet Delivery at Transpennine Express. I am a railway woman of 17 years. Oh, you become an old timer without realising it, don't you?
It happens to us all,
it
Rachel.
It sneaks up on you and then you think, gosh, I've been doing this a long time. And yeah, currently Head of Fleet Delivery at Transpennine Express. Before that, I was with the Railway Regulator, the ORR, for a couple of years. Before that, I was 11 years at Merseyrail. I've done loads of different jobs on the railway. I'd probably say I was an operator by profession.
Yeah.
And so working in fleet, I am the operations plant in the fleet department.
We'll get onto that in a minute. And for our listeners, Tony, who are not of the northern persuasion, this is going to be like 50 Shades of Northern today, isn't it? Because we've all got a slightly different northern accent.
Would you want me to turn my Midlands one on just to balance it out?
You're a Midlands, I've gone northern though, aren't you?
Yes, it's fascinating coming from the middle and watching the North v South debate, because you can be you can have a foot in either. We didn't plan this at all. It's great because I'm surrounded by these top women from the industry, which is really nice. And it's great we're going to talk about engineering and stuff. I told Stacey that I've got something to say that has made me laugh when I realised it, because we're in our house and we live just down the road from Stacey, it's turned out. We met for a coffee and I said, engineer. So I said, did you your own car maintenance then? She looked at me witheringly and said, I'm an engineer, not a mechanic.
Right answer.
And I only discovered that, I don't know if you were actually echoing this, but apparently it's one of the classic lines from Star Trek.
Was it?
Bones says,
I'm a doctor, not a mechanic.
You've echoed one of the most classic lines in sci-fi there. So
love that. Trivia,
but yeah, so she can't mend your car. So if you break down, actually, Stacey will tell you, she can probably diagnose what's wrong with it.
I'll just ask if you've done your maintenance properly.
Yeah. She'll get your logbook out.
And you're no better, are you, Rachel? Because I asked you the same question on the way over in the car.
And Jane has literally just asked me the same thing. And I said, no, I ring the garage. No.
So there we go. None of us are any good at car mechanics. Some of us know quite a lot about trains. And really, that's what we're going to talk about today. So on previous episodes of Parallel Lines, we've delved into how trains are specified, manufactured, you know, how do you get enough seats on them, and those kind of like early on in the life of a train kind of issues. And we had great fun talking about seats, for instance, and whether they're comfortable or not, whether there's enough of them or not, how do you fit a wheelchair on, that kind of thing. But today with you guys, it's really about, we'd like to go behind the curtain on some of the stuff that people don't see about getting the trains out every day, the right number of them in the right place, working with all the different bits working on them. And there's a lot of stuff behind there that people don't really see, do they? So that's what I'd love to talk to you about. And Rachel, I'd like to start with you on the ops side, because you just said there, you're not an engineer, you're an operator, as am I. So we share a bit of stuff in common there, don't we? Our worlds overlap. So tell us a bit about how your world looks in the world of engineering and fleet, but as an operator. Just talk a bit about that.
Yeah, so it's interesting we've gone on the sci-fi angle already. I was thinking about one of the famous quotes from Star Trek, the original series, where Scotty, as chief engineer, Captain Kirk asks him, how long is it going to take to fix the Enterprise, which is completely bust? And Scotty originally said something like 16 weeks. And then he's like, oh my God, we don't have 16 weeks. And he says, Captain, I'll do it for you in 8 hours. And he says, do you always revise your repair estimates upwards, Scotty? And Scotty says, no, but how else would I retain my reputation as a miracle worker? And I'd probably say that was the kind of the conflict and the healthy conflict in terms of having an operator in the engineering space is to say, often if you ask an engineer, what's the solution? The engineer wants the perfect solution. But from the point of view of is it good enough for passengers? Is it safe? Is it right? Is it going to be right this time? Can we replan this repairing to get it right, to get it perfect at another time? It's that kind of healthy conflict and that healthy pressure to say, yeah, you can have the train stood down for as long as you want to, but that's not how the operator is making their money. We're not maintaining trains for the sake of it. We're not maintaining trains for sitting them in depot the whole time. We are maintaining them so they're safe, comfortable, effective and efficient for passengers to use.
Interesting.
That's my mission, I suppose. Let's get them out in the morning. Let's keep them out as long as we can. Let's get them all tucked back up in the depot in the evening.
That's quite interesting, because when I remember years ago when I was learning about train fleets as a journalist and saying to a fleet director, I said, there's never anything outside the depots. And he said, good. And you know, to me, I'd always thought, well, you want to see a depot full of trains, because that shows. No, you want to see a depot empty of trains. That's when we're doing our job. If they're all sitting around outside, something's gone terribly wrong. And interestingly, a few years ago, it emerged from France that they'd got way too many trains because they maintained them badly. And I remember flying in over Le Landy. I think we talked about it in the first podcast. Yeah. And you could see these rows of TGVs just sitting outside. And then a new director started there and said, if we actually maintain them right, we could park a third of them forever. We've just got loads because we don't know how to maximise using them and getting them out and stuff. So if you're a rail enthusiast and wanted to write the numbers down and you go past an empty depot, don't be disappointed that you can't write the numbers down. Be really delighted that depot is doing its job.
They're out there making money with passengers on, getting people where they need to go. It's funny because we were talking about holidays, weren't we, on the way here, and just before we started recording, we're talking about where we're going on holiday. I was in Spain earlier in the year and I was astonished, and I think I knew this on one level, but it wasn't until I saw that the trains were only going between the main cities, maybe in the morning peak and the evening peak. And that's kind of alien to us, isn't it? We always say, well, it's an hourly service from 6 o'clock in the morning right through to midnight, and it's really alien to see a load of trains parked up at the depot between the peaks. Mm-hmm. It's more common in some on some routes in the country, but I think we sweat the asset in that way for a lot of the time.
So tell us a bit then, Stacey, about why. I mean, this is going to sound really basic, but we try and keep things kind of accessible on Parallel Lines, and people are interested in understanding just about why stuff happens and what happens. So at a really basic level, what do trains need to have in terms of maintenance? Why do they go back to the depot? We say, oh, they go back to bed at night at the depot. What's happening to those trains each day, or how often is it happening?
The number one priority for all of us is to make sure that we don't hurt anybody.
Yeah, sounds good.
Make sure we keep people alive and uninjured when they travel on the UK rail network. And I always find it, well, not fascinating, I'm really grateful that if you ever ask the general public, you know, what's their priority on the railway, they never say, well, I want to stay alive. They take that for granted.
They do.
And that's testament really to the UK rail industry and how safe it is, that people don't even really think about that, they don't contemplate that. But actually, there's lots of engineers in the background all working really hard to make sure that that is what happens. Mm-hmm. And the way we control that is similar to, you know, in the UK we have to give a car an MOT every year, and that's mandated. You know, you can't operate your car unless it's got a valid MOT. We don't quite have the same thing with trains, but it's similar, that we have a maintenance regime that we independently verify and make sure is fit for purpose. And the whole point of that maintenance regime is, number one, make sure we keep people safe. Number two is we keep the trains as reliable as we can. And number three is that it's also well balanced with delivering a service. As Rachel's already said, you know, as engineers, yes, we'd love to tinker with them all day, every day, but we can't do that because that's, you know, that's not what the railway needs and that's not what they're for. And similar to what Tony was just saying, I'm always really pleased when I go past the depot and there's nothing there, because that means everything is out in service. So in a nutshell, I suppose that's why they need maintenance, because we want to keep them safe and reliable and operating. We sometimes forget how many miles that trains do operate.
So tell us about that then, typically. So here in the north of England, some of the routes that we would know, so your most recent gig at Avanti, how many miles does a Pendolino do before it, you know, has somebody tinker with it, as you put it then?
I'll jump in there, because I've got some numbers written down.
Tony's got numbers. And, love it.
That feeds into,
you can tell he's an actual journalist rather than me just chatting.
Because I've written there. I had to do an interview on a local radio station a few weeks ago. They have a thing, it's Hereford and Worcester, but they have a thing every day, a listener can send in a question of the day. Ooh. And somebody had contacted him and said, how many miles do trains do in their life? So they hadn't got a clue. So I happened to have an email handy to Stacey's former boss at Avanti. And I just messaged him and said, so, you know, how many miles have your trains done? Because they're about halfway through their life. The tilting Pendolinos on the West Coast are about halfway through their design life. So I've got some numbers here. And I said to the presenter, before I tell you the number, these trains started in 2002.
Yes, the
Pendolinos. And so I said they're 23 years old. So how many miles do you think they will have done in those 23 years? And he said, well, they must be getting close to a million. So I said, sit down. And this was 25th of April, actually, the number. The one that went to bed on the highest number on the 25th of April at the end of the day had done 6,261,688 miles. That's half its life. So it's going to do over 12 million miles in its life.
Wow.
So taking into account a couple of those years were during COVID as well, where they had a bit of a rest.
They didn't run as many.
Wow. So I was glad the presenter was sitting down and he said, really? Yeah.
We might come back to that number in a minute, because that's the lifetime of a train.
So that feeds
into
then. And
that's super interesting. But day to day, Stacey, how many miles do they do like on the West Coast Main Line in a day or in a few days before they get some attention? Typically?
So typically a Pendolino will do between 800 and 1100 miles in a day, which is high compared to some, you know, most of the train operators. And they can stay out of the depot for 48 hours.
Okay.
But after 48 hours, they need to go back just to have some mandatory items checked. So they're just very simple things like making sure the windscreen wash is topped up, making sure the toilets are all empty, making sure that the sanding boxes are full. So for those that don't know, that most trains in the UK have sandboxes that deploy sand to the track just to support during braking, to increase friction during braking, and obviously a critical safety system. So those kind of really fundamental consumable bits need attention at least every 48 hours, but efforts are always made to get them back every night, given the mileage that they operate. Then in terms of something a bit more in depth, typically, I'm kind of talking a bit more generally across most fleets that I've worked with, but roughly about once a month they'll have something a bit more in depth, which can be done in most cases kind of overnight, where further checks will be done of mainly critical safety systems, but they'll do an underframe check, so that's underneath the train. Obviously running, you know, circa 1,000 miles a day, lots of things could happen and hit the train or, you know, and things like that.
Can be a bit naughty and fly around
and damage things. So we always like to have a check underneath and make sure everything's still intact and everything's still okay. And then you start going a bit further. So maybe every 4 to 6 months, there's something that means the train needs to be stopped during the daytime.
Yeah.
Where even more checks are done, and it might include things like, I don't know, checking the air conditioning's working properly, changing oils, changing filters, etc., checking the door function.
Where do some of the terms that we might have heard referred to, and forgive me, these might be old-fashioned terms, because, of course, I'm the daughter of a rolling stock engineer, so I was brought up on, you know, the language of the old-fashioned fitters. But I know of a, you know, an A exam and a B exam and an overhaul as things that happen in a depot. Yeah, so where do they fit into that?
So typically, and as more and more kind of more modern trains have come in with different manufacturers coming, they call them all different things.
Yeah.
But yeah, traditionally A, B exams. So an A exam would be like your overnight check, which I just said would be done, you know, roughly around once a month. And then your B exam would be that you do in the daytime, that you, the first time you have to stop a train in the day. And then you go into kind of more heavy stuff. So these are kind of more heavier component changes. So, you know, although we say that Pendolinos have operated, you know, a fair few million miles in their life so far, they're a bit like Trigger's broom in terms of, you know, things do get replaced. It's not as if it's the same wheels that have been operating on that train all that time. We change the wheels probably, you know, once every 800,000 million miles, something like that. And there's other maintenance that happens in the interim as well, where they put trains onto a big wheel lathe and make sure the shape of the wheels stay the right shape and all those kind of things. So you've kind of got a heavy overhaul roughly every kind of 800,000 to a million miles. And then probably every 6 to 10 years, you then bring them in for like a full kind of more refurbishment, which is changing carpets, seats, all those kind of things.
And that's what I was going to say about Tony's numbers, is that is fascinating, isn't it, when you think about those trains that we all recognise, those of us who live on the route, as those same inverted commas, Pendolinos have been operating since 2002. But it's not like a car, is it? It's not like if you bought a car and you were still running it 20 years later, it would basically be the same car, wouldn't it? You might change the tyres and you'd, of course, change brake pads and things like that. But basically, it would be the same car. These trains have had loads of different things changed on them, haven't they, over the years? Because that's what you do. You kind of...
Yep. I mean, other than the kind of body shell itself,
yeah,
most other things kind of have some significant attention or replacement during that time. And the way that certainly more modern trains are built is that they're built in a very kind of modular design. So though, you know, when we send things in for heavy maintenance, we don't send them onto depot, take a component off, do a full overhaul and then put that same component back on. We just whip them off, send them away, put a different one on, and that's the one that it then goes out to operate. And then those components get sent off normally to a heavy maintenance specialist that will overhaul those parts, and then it comes back onto the shop floor and might go onto a different train. And, you know, it's another big part that not many people will be aware of, but trying to keep track of all these components, where they all are, what their history is, you know, making sure they've all got the right serial number on, they're all modified to the right version.
Right.
There's a whole kind of scope of work around that bit as well, kind of making sure our configuration stays the same. It's not unheard of that you'll modify a train fleet and then after overhaul we've inadvertently unmodified it because it's not quite gone through the right management processes to make sure that modification goes on an overhauled bit of kit as well.
It's quite impressive, the Pendolinos, because we've talked about them and it applies to others as well, but they're very proud in Manchester. They do the wheels and bogies in Manchester, don't they?
They do,
still?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
they've got a complete set of wheels and bogies. So a train comes in and they lift it up, take all the bogies away, and they've got a new set all ready to roll in underneath it. And then while that's being put together, the ones are taken off and modified for the next train. So they all move on one, as it were, and at the end they've got a float left, which saves time. But it's really impressive.
That's clever.
They're very proud of it. The first time they were really doing it, they got us all in there to show us. They were dead proud to be... They are. Bit of Liverpool for it. They were dead proud.
Dead proud. They were made up, Tony.
But one of the other things, just while we're on that general maintenance thing, is now how clever the trains are at telling you when they're feeling poorly, as it were, which is a change from when I was a kid and you know, if the driver wrote down in his notebook, you know, it's making a bit of a knocking sound when it go past 60 miles an hour, and then somebody would drive it at 20 miles an hour and say, you can't hear it at 20. But now the messages that come in, what kind of things will the train tell you during the day? That how deep is that information that it'll tell you in advance of arriving home in the evening?
Well, it's getting cleverer and cleverer, you know, each time a new fleet comes in, but probably most trains on the UK network now have all got what we call a train management system on board, which is essentially a computer with a screen in the driving cab, and faults can appear on there, you know, from the various sensors that we have on board, and often, you know, advise a driver what to do as well, so they don't, doesn't just come up with a random fault code. It will say fault code XYZ, driver advice is to do XYZ as well. And
Give this a go, see if this clears it.
Now, on the flip side to that, and Rachel know about this as well, sometimes all this clever kit also gives us a few problems as well. And although it's all designed to make sure trains remain safe, and all of this technology is undoubtedly making the UK rail network more safe, but it can give us some reliability issues as well, because it's more things to go wrong.
Yeah.
And, you know, in my career, I've probably lost count of the number of times that something might report, a fault in a train might report as being something quite concerning, and we all kind of, you know, make sure we do the right thing and get the train stopped, but actually a lot of the time it's just the sensor that's gone faulty rather than the actual thing has gone wrong. But on the whole, though, it does its job in keeping the train safe. But as well as bits of kit on the trains, we've also got more and more things on the infrastructure side as well, so either on the Network Rail infrastructure or also on the train maintenance depots as well. The one that comes into mind the most is that Central Rivers Depot in Burton-on-Trent. They've got a clever bit of kit that every train going in goes through something called AVIS, which is Automatic Vehicle Inspection System, and that takes pictures 360 degrees round and does laser measurements of different things, measures brake pads, measures wheel sets, and you know, just lots of clever stuff, and flags an alarm if things are not looking quite right so they can plan that in. So there's lots of technology out there, loads of data, and actually yeah, thinking about it, it's one of the bigger challenges we have is how to make better use of that data.
And we've got to be clever about using it.
Yeah. So that crosses over into your world, doesn't it, Rachel, then? So you've got all this stuff riding around all day telling you stuff, and the engineers want to play with it and fix it. So where does that come into the tension of your world of kind of saying, well, when do you pull a train if it's telling you something? Yeah. What are the kind of challenges and parameters around that then?
And in that sense, the parameters have stayed the same from maybe your dad's day in it, from a legacy piece of equipment, a legacy train, where you would say the fitter might see that there's something wrong. They might get called out to ride with it, a mobile fitter. They'll go out, they'll say, I don't like the look of this, and it's best that we take it back to the depot for repair straight away. And in a lot of ways, my team do a similar job for Transpennine Express. They are based in the control centre, but the difference being now they've got all this clever equipment to monitor what the train's doing in real time, but it's still those people using their judgment and experience to say, I think that's not quite what it needed. For example, when we've had the hot weather over the past week and into the weekend, they can see from the desk in the control room how hot that train is and whether the actions that they're advising the driver to take to try and reset the air conditioner, whether that's actually bringing the temperature down to a comfortable level. So they've got loads of sources of information, but I think we could be cleverer with it. I think we could be using that information. This is an industry-wide challenge for how we respond to all the data that we're getting, how we can use that to, A, make exams quicker, easier, less involved for the technicians who are doing them, so it spends less time in the depot. This is a theme for me now, isn't it? I don't want them in the depot. Don't want the train in the depot. Yeah. I want it out. How we use it, and I know this, our partners at Siemens are using this really well at the minute. It comes into the depot, the production technicians can see on the screen the live feed from the train, essentially, that says what the fuel level is, so they can estimate from that how long it's going to stay on the fuel road, how long it's going to need to be connected to the diesel pump.
Can we just talk about fuel for a minute, because this is something we've talked about before on the podcast. That used to be, until recently, quite a big problem, didn't it? Knowing exactly how much a train had in terms of fuel, didn't it? So just talk a bit about how it's one of those things that you just think, really? When you hear somebody say it, you didn't know how much fuel was on it, but I know how much is on my car.
Yeah.
But we really didn't, did we, until quite recently, accurate measurement.
No, and you might have a sort of red, amber, green indication.
Yeah, like... broadly.
Yeah, so I've got, yeah, you know that, like Stacey says, if it's been to the depot within the last 24, 48 hours, they will have topped it up. You are effectively operating on a full tank each time, but then the driver will have an indication, but it can be quite vague. It can be kind of red, amber, green. It can be, you know, you've got between 5% and 20%. Now, I heard about that quite recently. I was like, well, that doesn't give me much. If I've got 20%, I know I've got plenty to get to. If it was in your car, you've got plenty to get to the petrol station and not worry too much about it. You've got 5%, so it can be quite a big range.
Yeah.
And so one of the good things now is that with the remote condition monitoring systems, some of the things that the control team have access to, the production teams at the depot, they can see much more accurately what level that is. But I think when you look at it from an operations point of view as well, the train planners plan quite conservatively.
Yes.
So they will they know within this space of time, you've got a range in miles that the train will be able to do. And during that time, it has to get back to somewhere, not necessarily a depot, it could have at a stabling point or somewhere where the facilities are not as extensive to have a bit of a top up with fuel.
That's quite a big change. Just when we were moving house a few months ago, I had to throw out all my old magazines and things. I've got hundreds and hundreds of magazines. But I sat in the shed looking at some railway magazines from the 1970s, and that they used to do a sort of log of all things that had gone wrong every month. And the number of trains that ran out of fuel back in the 70s...
It used to happen a lot.
Because there was just a gauge that sort of... It was like looking at us... you know, it'd be a gauge about a couple of inches high that's telling you whether you've got 900 gallons or 10, and you sort of tap the gauge a bit. Yeah. But the number of trains that broke down because they ran out of fuel was phenomenal, and you can't imagine that now. It's so rare that it ever happens.
It's rare. Something's gone wrong. Yeah, it does happen, but it's only when something, like maybe there's an engine isolated on the train, so instead of working off three engines, you're working off two, so the fuel consumption is greater. But that goes back to kind of the interface with operations having to be really good, that basic getting your ops plan right, making sure things are going back to the depot when they go, making sure your train plan is correct. The last line of defence almost is getting it on the fuel road when it's nearly empty.
We have to look at some of the distances, though. I mean, it's not like your car, is it, where, you know, in your car you might have your preferred place that you top up fuel, you know, because you get your Nectar points or your club car points or whatever. But if you're running low, you know you can always pop into the Esso garage and pay a fortune, just stick a tenner in because you're going to run out. It doesn't work like that with trains, does it? You've got to get to your fueling point or your depot, haven't you, basically? You've got to go somewhere which could be quite a long way from where the train is. So if something changes in disruption, for instance, and you've got to go a diversion route, or you've got to sit there a long time, burn a load of fuel you weren't planning to burn, that's how trains end up running out of fuel. It's generally not because somebody's done the planning wrong, is it? It's because something's changed and
There's lots of variables in
fuel.
Trying to keep track of all that.
It's not an exact science. Until recently, I used to tell graduate trainees that that's the way to making a million on the railways, like make your fortune by designing a really accurate way of tracking fuel consumption, because nobody's quite cracked it yet. It sounds like we're getting there with remote condition monitoring.
Better than it was, certainly. Yeah. But I think what I'm always conscious of as well is that diesel fleets are becoming unfashionable.
That they are
for sustainability
on the
reasons.
Decline, yeah.
Yeah, and it's for sustainability reasons, and you think the amount of fuel that we're using, the amount of electrification that is or isn't, there's a whole other podcast, isn't it?
That's a whole other discussion.
But the amount of electrification there is or isn't, and now we're kind of, as an industry, moving towards particularly bi-mode trains that can operate on overhead wires or on diesel, but on batteries as well, so tri-mode trains that have battery capability. It's got to be the way forward to really decarbonise ourselves as an industry.
Because we're pretty green to start with, aren't we, in rail? But we could do better if we got rid of all the diesels, couldn't we? We need more wires up.
So the interesting thing will be with the bi-mode trains, of course. If something goes wrong with the electric bit, they can quite often carry on driving them as a diesel train to get the journey finished. But if the plan was that they would only do 500 miles during the day on diesel and suddenly they're doing 1,000, then that's when you need the remote monitoring of the trains to say, now we're
It's not going to get
to the end of the day on this. But the interesting thing as well, for both of you, that the information that comes in during the day is so useful because you can plan for the evening as well. Years ago, where they introduced pit stop maintenance, and they said it's going to be exactly like you see on Formula One on the telly. When the car comes into the pits and they do the wheel change in 4.3 seconds or faster, 1.2, they don't say, oh, you're in for the wheels, hang on a minute, and they go and rummage in the stores. They're already for it, and sometimes they change the front of the car or rebolt it, and they introduce that. So when a train arrives in the evening and it arrives into the depot, the box of the spare parts for the bit is sitting next to where it needs to go on the train. It saves hours. But the trains are actually telling them ahead, when I come to bed tonight, this is what I'm going to need. I remember being in a control room once and an alarm went, and it was just a toilet door, and the motor was getting hot every time somebody used the door. And they said that the motor's about to go, or there's something, the track needs cleaning, but the door is taking a real effort to close it. So it's going to carry on closing for the rest of the day. The people will have a toilet, but you wouldn't want to run it again tomorrow with that motor getting hot. And so they could get the kit ready to do the repair, which is so much different to the old days where somebody had to get the meters out in the evening and say, which door is it then, or wait until it failed and everybody's complaining to the train manager that the toilets aren't working anymore or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the data that we get, that's the biggest opportunity, which we've already taken in a lot of ways, just to do that more planned maintenance, so that we're not trying to diagnose things on depot. We already know what's wrong with it by the time it arrives, and we do that a lot. And I say, just on the Pendolino fleet there used to be kind of what they call like super technicians that were on the shop floor, dealing with the more complex faults physically on trains, getting the schematics out and such like. But now they tend to work day shift on the Pendolinos, and they're monitoring the trains in service, looking at what faults are coming in and writing instructions of what they want the guys to do that night.
So they can maximise that time on
exactly,
depot.
Yeah, so we've not got that diagnostic time while the train's stopped.
Yeah.
That's all happening while the train's running around in service, and then, like as Tony says, the people, the bits and everything they need is all ready when the train arrives.
So where it goes wrong for everyone is like in the hot weather last week, and when I came back from London on Friday, there'd been chaos during the day, there'd been lineside fires, there'd been all sorts of things, and all the trains were being shuffled around to try and get them going somewhere. I got on a train back up here that was going to Glasgow that should have been going to Liverpool and everything, but that means that lots of people have got to do some very quick number crunching because the trains are going to go to bed in the wrong place. So the people in Liverpool that had all got the bits ready for that train in the evening were going to be getting another train that they weren't expecting. And so when people are saying, you know, standing at Euston, saying, why don't they just use that one then? It's not quite as easy, is it? And sometimes you know you've only got a couple of hundred miles left that it can do before it needs to be looked at, and so we can't go to Glasgow.
And with trains getting more and more complex, and the Pendolinos were a great example of that, where they're complex but they're also very long, so they don't just fit anywhere. Like, you've got to plan where they're going to go. And also the bits of kit we need to be able to fix things, we don't just have loads of them. They're quite often just at one or two depots across the country. So if they don't end up there, then whatever fault it is doesn't get fixed. It's a constant balancing act between what's the most kind of important defects to fix each night, especially when you do get disruption, because it does throw the plan.
And there's a couple of... So a funny story springs to mind, which... about my dad. I like to tell funny stories I've learned over the years from my dad. So... All this whizzy technology is really great, and we're cleverer than ever, aren't we? But we're also more restricted in other ways. So we've mentioned safety, absolutely really important, and you know, performance and what have you. But safety in particular is bigger than ever. And so people work within standards and parameters and with standardised kits, standardised parts and everything. One of my dad's most favourite stories, and Rachel, you'll laugh at this, being someone who knows Heaton Depot intimately, which is where my dad worked for years. They used to have the old bit... Well, they've still got the old bit, actually, that nobody uses. But it used to have old locos just, like, parked up there and a load of stuff in the shed that nobody's using anymore. This is, like, in the 80s, you know, after the steam locos had retired, but there was still loads of stuff just kicking about places. And my dad will describe in great detail repairing the trains that were meant to be there on Heaton Depot, so HSTs, that's what that depot was built for, just having a wander over to see what he could find in the old bit because, you know, he needed... something that he didn't have, and you know, a fault had arisen on depot that night, and he'd just bodge something, basically just put something together like you would in your shed to fix it, to get it out. You'd never do that now, would you? The guys on depot wouldn't dare do that now, because you know, what if it went wrong and you'd put some non-standard or non-approved or, you know, whatever part. They're all, you mentioned serial numbers, Stacey, they're all parts that are tracked, you know, exactly where it's come from, and it's a part that's supposed to do this one job. You know, he would tell you he'd practically fix something with a bit of knicker elastic, you know, if it meant they'd get the fan fixed and it could go out. You know, that just doesn't happen anymore.
Inspectors fix a lot of things with duct tape and cable tape.
But you can do a lot with gaffer tape, can't you?
You can do an awful lot with duct tape, but that's a kind of in the field kind of, let's get it back to the depot.
A temporary solution.
A temporary repair.
Yeah.
But I think, going on a slightly different tack as well, but fleet management, engineering, technicians in depot suffering the same thing that a lot of other parts of the railway are suffering with at the minute, that it is an ageing workforce.
Yeah.
That you've got some really clever technicians, some really good engineers who are coming on for retirement in the next few years, and maybe there's been a bit, you know, apprenticeships are great these days and there are a lot more organisations offering apprenticeships and degree apprenticeships, but are we giving future technicians the best chance of maintaining a big, you know, the national fleet, if you like? Are we doing enough to capture that knowledge, or can fix that with a bit of duct tape and knicker elastic?
Yeah.
We need to capture that somehow.
But also giving them the freedom to know they can do, and I'm not sure people have now, not just on depots, by the way. I just think across all disciplines and everywhere now, people are far more inclined to follow the rules and the instructions in the manual, so to speak, you know, the inverted commas manual, and not stray outside that. I know I saw it in managing the control team environment. You know, people are far less willing to go outside the parameters of what, you know, the safety management system tells you you can do and you should do, which is great in some ways. It keeps us all safe, you know, it makes it easier for assessing people, it makes it easier to train people because you're telling them this is how you do it. But that creative thinking of, oh, I've seen this before, I kind of know what's needed, and I feel like if I put something in place that's slightly non-standard, I won't get sacked for it. You know, that kind of thinking has kind of died off a bit, I think.
It's getting the right balance, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Because a couple of years ago, I saw a train. I won't mention the company that was operating it. but they'd mended it, covered up some rust with parcel tape, the brown stuff.
Oh.
Now, you know, a light shower and that's off.
That's not very sticky to start with,
is it? So I was there going, have you not even got any duct tape? You know, at least if you're going to tape over something, use something that will withstand the rain. But... You know, I thought somebody there has almost used the wrong bit of initiative.
Yeah.
But also that sort of inherited expertise that you build up over years is something that's very important. And for people out there who, two of you come from Merseyside, where the new trains that started there, you know, the most unreliable trains we've ever had in the world, apparently, having forgotten that the ones they had before were incredibly unreliable when they started. But part of the thing is not just the trains settling down into use, but it's the engineers who know, if it's making that noise, or if it's doing that, or if it's using more electricity than it should, it's probably, it's worth looking at, or I wonder if it's the thing. And
I'm gonna call you out, Tony, actually, because 507s are 508 to my babies. And you're entirely right, what you're saying is that they were unreliable before. New trains are unreliable. Yeah. New trains go through a horrible, horrible sort of bathtub curve of being horribly unreliable. I would like to think that the people of Merseyside, you could never prepare people for that. They'd say, we're getting a brand new fleet and it's going to be lovely. And they're lovely trains, really nice. The 507s and 508s, people knew how to maintain them.
Yeah.
In that sense, design of a new train is one thing. Maintenance is equally important, and how they can get to grips with the new systems that are involved. Very, very different trains getting to grips with the new systems involved and learning those tricks to be able to get them running again when either they failed in service or when there's something tricky on the depot, where those experienced technicians would have gone, I've seen this before and I think I know what's wrong with that, and I'm gonna give that a whirl. And so they were my babies. Sorry, Tony.
I've wanted to defend the engineering teams, really, because I'm sure they're not doing it deliberately.
Absolutely.
People on Merseyside or people elsewhere that are getting new trains, South Wales have had problems with theirs.
Let's be honest, Tony, all new trains have had problems.
Yeah, well, that's what I was coming to. Yes, all new trains go through, as you referred to, the bathtub curve. They start at a bit of reliability. It drops before everyone gets all familiar. Drivers, engineers, everybody get familiar, and they have that conversation. The driver brings the train back at the end of the day and just says, a bit sluggish. There was nothing coming up, but it's definitely, you know, I was losing time between every station. And eventually an engineer goes, we had one in 2 days ago that was doing that, let's check this on the software or whatever. And so they're not doing it deliberately, and the manufacturers aren't doing it deliberately because they're not British, which is the other, read the BBC news stories. Well, if we'd bought British, they'd be perfect. Really, do you want a list of all the British built trains that went wrong over the years? But nobody's doing it deliberately. It's what happens over the world, isn't it? Stacey might be travelling the world in her new job, and she's gonna learn what the phrase bathtub curve is in lots of languages. But
seeing as how we've gotten onto it, on Merseyside, I think for me, the big difference has been why we've seen it so pronounced there is because, unlike maybe, Rachel, some of the new trains projects you've worked on more recently, I'm thinking of TPE, for instance, the Merseyrail staff were going from basically having like a larder to a Ferrari, or, you know, a train to a spaceship. Like, the difference in what they had to what they then had to work with was so different, and most of them had never seen the inside of I'm talking about drivers now, from my perspective, from the operating side, they'd never driven another kind of train. They'd only ever driven a 507, and then you give them this whizzy computer based, you know, I've got to press all these buttons for doors, I've got to do all this stuff that I've never had to do before. The step up was huge compared to, like, say, you're on TPE, you've driven a 185, you know, and then you're moving on to a 397 or an 802. Okay, they're different and you need to train for it, but it's not that huge gap, you know what I mean?
A lot smaller, yeah.
Yeah.
People being proud of how long those old trains lasted, which they did, need to remember that meant the technology on them was that much older.
That's what made me think of it, you know, when you think of a repair that you couldn't, obviously a lot of the equipment on those trains was obsolete.
Yeah.
And you'd have to sort of ring up Bob's engineering on the Wirral or something like
that. And
all
quite mechanical as well, because no computer-based systems, you know.
But that's exactly it. And you'd have to say, hey, Bob, can you manufacture me this little widget? Because I can't buy it from anywhere. So I need some of those for my fleet. With the new trains and the new systems, you almost just as well have an IT technicians in the depot to understand those interfaces with the digital systems. We talk a lot about the router on board and the wayside systems, and people have lost me pretty much instantly, well beyond my capability and my competence to talk about those things. But we do have big teams of specialists now who deal with that in terms of the maintenance side of the rolling stock. So again, totally different train, totally different systems to get used to.
And are your teams changing then, Stacey, in the engineering world? Because are you a mechanical engineer?
So I'm mechanical.
Yeah, trains used to be very mechanical. You know, my dad, if in doubt, give it a clout. You know, very kind of metal on metal and cranking things. As Rachel's just kind of explained there, now it's plug it in, have a listen to it, what it's telling you, have a readout on a screen, you know, that kind of stuff. So what kind of people are you starting to recruit now as engineers? Is it less mechanical, more... I don't know what you'd even call that. Are they electrical engineers or software engineers?
Software engineers. Yeah. So, it is a big challenge in the railway because obviously software is it's not new. It's, you know, software's been around for a while, but in terms of the rail industry and rolling stock, more and more software is still new to a lot of people. But we still do have the mechanical aspects and electrical aspects as well. Mm. So it's about... I suppose it's like a systems engineer that you need that has a good appreciation of all of it. Now, I am mechanical by trade in terms of what I did at university. And then I've been exposed to more and more electrical as I've gone through my career. And then, say, in the last 5 to 10 years, it's all been about software. One of my roles in my last two kind of positions really was to help upskill my team so they did understand a bit more. Now, they're never going to be computer programmers. You know, that's not what we pay them to do, but it's about having that understanding and appreciation of how we manage it and identifying what could be a software issue, how we manage changes to software. We talk about the bathtub curve with modern trains to get trains initially out of their dip in reliability. A lot of the changes you need to make is software, and managing all these bits of software on board, and especially ones that control safety critical bits on the train. You know, we as engineers in the train operators, we have to sign off on those changes. And I must admit, there were times when I was at TransPennine with all the new fleets coming in and a change pack would be presented to me, which was a software change, and it'd have all this technical detail of... it was over my head. I was like, my word, I have no idea. Like, I don't really understand what they've done. You know, and just kind of having to trust the
having experts.
Having a look at,
and,
you know, who has designed this and what was their competence. And taking your assurance from that. But since then, the industry has moved on quite a bit. There's some specific courses now for how to manage changes to safety critical software and et cetera. But it's, we are still on a learning curve.
Don't you think it's a big shout out to the railway, though, that, you know, if you're not sure what you want to do, and if you're speaking to any teenagers, I've got conversations like this going on in my world at the minute, and you're not sure what you want to do, but you're interested in stuff and, like, how... stuff works and interacts. Like, I think that's the railway all over, because you're a mechanical engineer, Rachel and I are not engineers, but you end up, when you've got a career on the railway, understanding quite a bit about other types of engineering, or, you know, you learn a bit about geotech here and there, you know a bit about civil engineering, you know a bit about people because you have to, etc. And so you might well be a specialist in your field, and you are, but you have an appreciation for all those other disciplines because you kind of have to, don't you, to know how they interact.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm always surprised at how much we get involved with. And I think if anyone had ever told me at university days, oh, you're going to have a role in the railway, and how much we'd be talking about toilets and essentially...
Oh my gosh, toilets.
Essentially like plumbing.
Yeah.
I'm focused on toilets.
I forgot about that when Tony mentioned toilet doors, and that is the Venn diagram of things we spend too much time talking about on the railway. Yeah. The toilet's broken and the toilet door's broken, because doors and toilets, I feel like, take up much of our time, don't they?
Absolutely. But it's an important part of a customer experience,
I mean,
isn't it?
But when you've got to go, you've got to go.
Trying to make sure it works.
Unless you're on Merseyrail, in which case you can't.
You don't need to go.
All the Valley Lines coming soon, tram trains. But the interesting thing about the software is sometimes you've got to be very careful that you don't create another problem. And we could do a whole podcast on the last 20 years and how a software upgrade has created a completely different problem that nobody saw coming, some of which have nearly been safety critical, some of which have the Pendolino rolling into the buffers at Lyme Street, quite a lot of trains on the south of England that had some really serious problems, the Siemens electric trains. They did a brilliant upgrade that completely collapsed another part of the software. And it's not as easy as just changing a line of code.
No, you've got to be really, really careful. And I know, I said, not just the rail industry, but within the software world, there's lots of kind of standards and regulations now all coming in to help manage that. But then the other side of it as well, which has a big safety aspect, is the cybersecurity side. With our trains becoming more and more connected to the outside world, it's what could happen from a cyber's perspective. And certainly, Anna Jane, you said about younger people coming through and what they might want to do, but the world of cybersecurity is a mega opportunity. Yeah. If people understand cybersecurity, that, you know, I think that's something the railway needs more of to help future-proof it, as well as probably many other industries.
Siemens have recruited some former hackers to their team in Germany to help them work on cybersecurity because I was over there.
Poacher turned gamekeeper, call that.
And they were really interesting because they are there, say, they are there to employed to find holes in the system, basically. Mm-hmm. I remember asking them, I said, would you travel in a driverless train on a high-speed line? And all of them just said, absolutely no. We want someone at the front with a big red button that just sort of said, panic, stop.
Can override
because
everything.
whatever you think, it might be okay on a little metro that's trundling at 30 miles an hour, but they wouldn't be doing 150.
But that's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, we were maybe getting closer and closer to the concept of driverless trains. You know, you could maybe see a future where that would happen, but the cybersecurity thing has probably, for now anyway, put place to that, because I can't imagine people
certainly
would feel safe.
Few more obstacles in the way.
Doesn't it? It makes that bar even higher for people's trust to get, you know, over that. That, hang on a minute, you're gonna just have trains trundling along, but they can be hacked by somebody in another country, for instance. Yeah, don't feel like we're there yet.
No.
You only have to look at your phone, don't you, with all the different bug updates on the apps and think, yeah.
You don't want someone on their phone on the platform that's pressing a button, why is the train not going? Somebody on the platform's taking control. You. Just got to say, by the way, if you can hear somebody, are they? It sounds like they're cutting a hedge or something outside. International Women in Engineering Day, somebody's outside doing a hedge just to make it sound sort of engineering-y.
Could be in the depot. You could have kid on that we were in the depot.
Yeah, nobody would know.
It's the planning it took. I was just the planning it took to get a neighbour to do the hedge today. You don't know. Either of you might be able to answer this, but when the space shuttle came out of use, and they were trying to find, was it 386 processors on scrapyards, because it was still running that old, but it was running Windows 95 or something. Some of the trains are still running quite old Windows, because nobody, the Voyagers got talked about quite a lot as still being running on, what were they, on Windows 95, were they?
Yeah, I think Windows 95, but I also remember when I looked after Class 170s at TPE, Bombardier at the time at Crofton Depot were frantically looking on eBay for like old laptops that would
to get the downloads.
Downloads of things. And it is, you know, with the train life being kind of 35, 40 years, one of the biggest challenges we'll have is how we keep the technology up to speed.
And of course this is different coming back to other countries and how they do it, which we've touched on in a number of ways during this discussion. Other countries like Japan, for instance, they don't have such a long life for their trains, do they? They have typically half, I think, the build life that we have. So we've chosen to do that, haven't we? And said, right, we want like 40 years out of our trains. But then that means you've got to have the parts and the people to keep it going for 40 years.
We ask a lot of our trains.
We do, don't we?
A lot of it in terms of the life, in terms of being able to support new requirements, being able to modify them at times in their life, to do different things as customer preferences change, and then to be able to run such an intensive service, we ask quite a lot.
We do ask
a lot.
You don't ask as much from your car, and other countries don't ask as much of their trains, do they? I mean, even from an aesthetics point of view, we've talked about Pendolinos a lot, but they're a good example. They were really like, wow, when they first came out, weren't they? They were really
space age.
Really different. And the design of them, just aesthetically, was really different to what we'd ever seen before, wasn't it? And they looked really new for a while. But now, I mean, they've all been refurbed pretty much now, haven't they? But before they were refurbed over the last couple of years, they were starting to look quite a bit 90s, weren't they? Because coming in 2002, they were obviously designed in the 90s, weren't they? And you could tell because, like, the colour scheme and the sort of, you know, quite a lot of plastic bits that looked a bit, you know, whereas now you'd probably have wood or metal if you were using the modern approach. So things do date, don't they? And customers associate that with, it's probably not as good, even though it's still practically, you know, capable of doing what it needs to do. Customers associate the aesthetic with kind of, old is old and not that good, and new is, it's new and brilliant.
But you can also fool them so easily. So people will remember just after COVID, and there was the temporary train on the Shetland Carlisle for the tourists, and for the last year of it they got an old high speed train and refettled it, nice leather seats inside, and they painted it a new livery and really cleaned it up, and I went on the debut and you could still smell the paint because deadlines were a bit tight, and there were people on it sitting opposite from the tourist board saying, fancy getting a new train for this? 42 years old, guys, you know, but just because you put a new paint on. But it's amazing, actually, if you get the refurbs right or the aesthetics right, you can convince people they've got a brand new train, which is an interesting thing. New paint equals new train, clearly.
Yeah, you know? I heard after the Pendolinos started their refurbishment, I travelled on the Pendolinos a lot going to and from the office, and on more than one occasion I heard people get on going, oh, so we're on a new train today.
And it's, yeah, like, you know, it made me feel quite really a lot
proud, because I was a big part of that refurb. Yeah. You're like, oh, they think it's a new train.
Yeah. That means something's been done really well.
Something's been done well. But we also saw, you know, in terms of all the customer surveys that the marketing team did, the uplift in customer satisfaction really went up with the new trains.
Mm.
And then as we kind of got more than halfway through the refurbishment, the older ones were going down, because it was kind of their standards had changed.
Right.
You know, customer standards had changed of what they expect. And I suppose going back to your point, things do change and customers' expectations change, and we've got to make sure we keep up with it.
Yeah.
Do you remember the big, you know, how easy is it to fool people survey they did in Merseyrail with the old trains? And for their last few years, the old ones, they had one side was yellow and one side was silver. So you never knew there were different colours on each side, because you never walked around. And they did a survey and asked people which they thought were better. And one colour came out better than the other. We like the yellow trains. Yeah, but you know, there were the silver ones on the others. You can fool people with almost anything if you get the refurb right or the paint right.
That was the only way I could tell which was the A end and which was the B end, which was the A and B cab. But as well, sometimes you get, like, this is an illustration of the things we sometimes get asked to get involved in. If someone was filming, for example, at Southport Station, you'd be asked to make sure that the trains were marshalled in a certain way coming out of the depot, so you'd have all the grey, so you'd have a six car with all the grey side, or all the yellow side facing the platform. And that's a massive headache. Obviously, it was important for the aesthetics of whatever they were filming, but that's the sort of
turning
thing.
Turning a train is not very easy, is it?
No, you're coming out of Cadiz. There's one way out of Cadiz.
Yeah, there's only one way in and out,
And then, you know, it's not a loco operation. We don't run things round, you know. So.
But that's a classic you get on the railway. You get this question a lot. It's, can you just... ... And the person asking it is usually somebody who doesn't really understand the extent of what they're asking. And they sort of just, can you just... sort this for us, as though it's not a big ask.
Exactly. It's totally our job to educate people, isn't it, on all the ins and outs, and hopefully we can draw that curtain back on to this. No, you can't have it the right way around. You can't have it
Well, you can, but it'll take us this amount of work to do it.
Cancel three trains to be able to get it the right way around. No, you can't.
I would guess that something like the comms team, we've got a press event, so we want X train, it's got to be the one, or we mustn't have so-and-so because it's the wrong football team's name on the side or something, and it'll really offend people. And they think they're just going to sort of phone up the depot and say, oh, could you send City of Liverpool in because it's something happening at Liverpool? Yeah, but that's in Wolverhampton and it's supposed to be going to Glasgow tomorrow. We can't just...
You normally need a good few days to get something to happen, and you are also... Fingers crossed.
You're watching it every day for at least a week, aren't you? Yeah. We did that. We wrapped a train for Eurovision when that was in Liverpool. Yeah. Oh, my God. Getting that to go on Liverpool diagrams every day was...
Yeah.
Again, you'd watch it, and then by the end of the week, there was a bit hanging off, and the toilets were all not working and stuff like that. So you wanted it at Liverpool.
Yeah. You didn't say it had to look good. You just wanted it at Liverpool.
You didn't say it had to work perfectly well. It just needs to sit there looking good.
Mm. So. Also, the thing for looking after the trains, the thing is, right at the beginning, we were saying they had to have sort of more heavy maintenance every X thousand miles or whatever. But you don't want them all to hit that next Thursday. You had 56 Pendolinos, so you need those to get to the same mileage for being overhauled 1 week apart. And that's a lot of planning out. And the moment there's a bit of disruption and they all go to the wrong place, all the miles go, and then you've got to reprogram it to get them back, because you don't want to repair a train too early and waste, well, there's 100,000 miles left in that component and we've replaced it too early, but you can't let it run on past the deadline either, because it's dangerous.
Mm.
So the cleverness of the people with these big train fleets to get them to all hit the mileage to be overhauled 1 month apart or 1 week apart or whatever is a huge exercise, isn't it? But it's worth millions over a year getting it right.
There's a lot of moving parts. We're doing a bogey and wheel set overhaul on one of our fleets at the minute. Are the bogies and wheel sets arriving at the right place at the right time? Is everyone set up to receive it at the overhaul location? Is everyone set up to receive it when it comes back to its home depot? How can you minimise that time? Again, that kind of production engineering side of it. How do you make sure everything is in the right and logistically in the right place at the right time? When do you send the train over to make sure that you're not constraining the availability of the fleet for passenger service. When do you bring it back? Yeah. When do you send the next one? How do you make that whole process quicker and tighter as it goes on?
And there's not a load of space, is there? So, like, you know the overhaul, for instance, is starting, but, you know, a logical thing to think might be, oh, well, let's get it there 2 days early to make sure that it's not late. But then there's nowhere for it to sit for 2 days because there's so much else going on that location that you can't just have things waiting around just in case. You have to land things on the nose, don't you, really, with all these moving parts, as you say, Rachel. And
Well, exactly what. It just makes me think as well that I'm fortunate to be able to do this sort of thing. I'm not a clever engineer. I don't need to know how each system works necessarily. I need to know why we need to do certain things, and I need to know when they're supposed to be done, and I need to know that it's my job to make sure it all happens in the right sequence at the right time. And what you said before about career for someone on the railway being varied and being exciting and interesting and not exactly knowing what you're going into at any one day, there's a real need for clever people who can make that sort of thing happen as well.
Yeah.
And if you like change day by day, if you like not being entirely sure that things that are supposed to happen are going to happen, and feeling the having the responsibility to be able to make it happen, then it's a great thing to do. It's a great job that I've got. I love doing it.
I'm just going to talk you up because you just did a women thing there and went, I'm not a clever engineer, but no, you're not a clever engineer, but you are a clever operator and you are a clever problem solver and a clever lots of other things. So just because you're not an engineer,
you know. Say that to me again when you're trying to Manchester's cancelled. I'll be getting a message saying, you said you knew what you were doing, Rich. You said you knew what you were doing.
We've talked for an hour about looking after trains and fleets and things, and I suspect there's about another 20 hours we could have just carried on because there is so much to learn, so we're going to get them back. As nearly everyone we get on this, we say you'll have to come back. So at some point, it's going to be like the Parkinson show where Muhammad Ali was on every 3 years or whatever, for those that are that old. But I'm still learning more and more about looking after trains and that whole thing. And for people out there, just remember, if your train is missing because it's broken down or because there's been disruption, there's nobody smiling. There are a lot of frustrated people, and there's a lot of clever people making sure that the depots are empty and the tracks are full, as it were. So that's episode 12. If you've got questions on looking after train fleets, send them in, because we'll get them back then and we'll ask them lots of
I feel like this is
questions.
One of those ones where if we've piqued your interest with anything we've said that you'd like to know more about, there might be a future episode, I don't know, maybe about toilets or doors, instance.
Special issues on seats and doors. We'll do a special. Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.